This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf-Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart original.
Content warning. This episode discusses cyberbullying and suicide. In our last episode of Made Accounts, we spoke with Tina Meyer, mother of Megan Meyer and the founder of the Megan Meyer Foundation. It was an incredibly moving episode, and we had a great deal of interest in hearing more from Tina. So here is a bonus episode, the full interview with Tina Meyer.
Megan was, from the moment she was born, the kid that just moved nonstop and was always curious about things, wanted to know about things. She loved pleasing people. She liked doing things for people, making them happy. Some of the things when Megan was growing up, she really struggled with the way she looked compared to other girls. So her self-esteem really, she struggled quite a bit with that. She always compared herself that the other girls were thinner or if the other girls that she thought were prettier. And, you know, no matter how many times I would say, honey, you're beautiful the way you are, we're all different. Megan, you know, she struggled with that. And so she would always then try to really kind of show so much friendship to people. I think it's almost like she wanted them to, those popular kids, to really just be friends with her. But in between, she would have these parts of her when she would just finally relax and be okay with who she was. She had this amazing sense of humor. She could make me laugh till I had tears rolling down my face. It didn't matter if I was in the store, if I was driving, where I was at. She was so funny. And, you know, she loved scary movies. She loved music, all kinds of music. She liked All American Rejects. She loved Bow Wow. She loved Beyonce. She loved so many different artists back in the day. Hip hop was definitely one of her biggest things that she loved. She had a kind of a mixture of where she was very girly, but then she also could take a worm off of a hook, where like I could never do something like that. She had this mixture. But she liked lip gloss and eyeliner and straightening her hair. And she was just this really cool, great kid. I mean, on top of everything else, She was great. Her laughter to me was like what I miss. One of the biggest things I miss about her is her laughter.
Do you remember what age she started worrying about her looks? Do you remember that transition?
Oh yeah. Kindergarten was when Megan noticed the other girls. She looked like she was in second grade. You know, she was taller, not overweight, but she was not tiny and petite. And so, you know, when she's started kindergarten, these girls she noticed sitting next to her, their legs were smaller or they weren't as tall. And she instantly, you know, said, "Their mom, they're prettier than me, they're skinnier than me," and was really focusing on that a lot. And, you know, I struggled with weight my whole life, and I never wanted that for her. And so we talked more about being happy with who you are and being healthy, you know, and not, we didn't talk about diets, we didn't talk about any of that. And it was really hard seeing her struggle through that.
I imagine if it started that young, it would have been, you might have noticed more of it as she got older.
Oh, absolutely. It only intensified the older Megan got. You know, when kids are in first grade, second grade, and third grade, they start figuring out, you know, what girls like what boys and what boys like what girls. And, you know, even though it seems very innocent, which it is at that time, for a girl who is struggling with her self-esteem, trying to figure out how to fit that mold. And when she doesn't fit that mold, really struggling with it. And she struggled quite a bit. I tried getting her involved in extracurricular activities because I thought, you know, I knew that maybe if she got involved something else outside of school, she could have a different, you know, feeling, connection, where she didn't feel it was all focused on that. But Megan was diagnosed in third grade with attention deficit disorder and also depression. So we knew that she would start something and then she would kind of get bored of it very quickly. So we kind of ran through quite a few activities in third, fourth, and fifth grade that Megan would start and then be like, "Eh, no, this isn't for me."
Do you remember when she started using the computer? Was there an age when you got a computer, or how did that transition happen?
So with computers, I was a real estate agent, so I definitely had to have a computer, and we had the old, big, bulky, huge monitor downstairs where I had an office area, and the girls had a big playroom downstairs. That was a finished basement. And then we also had a laptop. And, you know, the girls would play some games or different things on there. But really, when Megan started with wanting to have a MySpace account was when she was going into eighth grade. And, you know, I was a nervous wreck about it. I monitored everything that they did. So, and I also watched the news. I watched 2020 and How to Catch a Predator. So, you know, my fear was sexual predators. On top of the fact that I had a kid who had struggled for so long with her self-esteem and self-worth, that I was worried that somebody could say something nice to Megan and, you know, get her to meet them at the mall or go to the movies. And I was just, those were things that I was always concerned with.
I have to imagine that must have been a little bit confusing because MySpace was still new. And I'm sure you understood there wouldn't have been chaperones or teachers necessarily that were monitoring these groups. What did you understand of MySpace at that time? And how involved were you with her online interactions?
So the first time I found out, actually prior to her asking for MySpace, was Megan and her friend had spent the night at my cousin's house, my aunt and cousin. And my cousin was searching on history after Megan spent the night and saw that Megan and her friend had created a fake MySpace account with a different person's picture on there and were talking to people. I was horrified. I mean, it felt at that time for me, I was so upset. I'm thinking, why would she do that? And, you know, after I talked to her about it, it was her and her friend Sarah had created this account. They found a picture of a really pretty girl because they didn't think they were pretty. And they wanted to talk to boys. And I found out that Megan had actually was talking to these boys and showed them a real picture of her and said, "It's not, this picture really isn't me." But at that point in time, it made me realize that they can have access anywhere. Like, this is really scary. And, you know, even putting her picture out there, not knowing who the other person was, you know, so I tried explaining to Megan about, you know, we need to get this shut down. This is not okay to put a fake picture out there. I understand that you finally told them that this is really you, but that's not the way it's going to work. Megan begged me to not cut her off from these two boys that she had talked to. I really had a hard time because I needed to know that these boys were real. So I told her that I needed their phone numbers, their parents' number, that if they were going to have like a, you know, discussion where they could talk or whatever, I needed to know. And I did talk to both of the parents and said, here's where it's at. Here's what my concerns are. Megan is, you know, we monitor everything. Are you okay if they talk every once in a while to make sure? And I did get that okay. And so I told her, you know, I will let you, because I knew Megan, if I didn't, Megan would find a way. Believe me, she would have found a way. And so I had to at least do my due diligence of trying to protect her. And so they did talk after that. That was the very first interaction. And then when Megan asked about MySpace and wanting to be able to have that MySpace again, starting eighth grade, I instantly was like, nope, no way. No, you cannot have this. And she begged me. And she wanted, back then it was MySpace and AOL Instant Messenger. Those were the two big things. And I was like, Megan, you're not even old enough. Like, you have to be 14 years old. You're 13, going to be turning 14 in a few months. And she begged me every single day. And I started looking into what could I do? How could I allow her to have it, protect her? How could I do that at the same time? And I came up with some rules. And, you know, they would not work in today's world. But the rules were, I said, Megan, here's the thing. I will let you have the MySpace, but I have the password only. You do not have the password to your account. The computers have to be in open spaces, never allowed. And, you know, the laptop could not go into her bedroom. I had to approve anything that went on her page. And I also had to make sure that it had to stay private. And I even purchased this program that was called WatchRight way back in the day. And it came in a disc in the mail. And it would monitor every instant message and every website that she visited. So I told her about all these rules. I didn't hide anything. And she was not too thrilled with me, I can tell you. She told me that I was a warden of a prison, that there was no other parent as strict as I was, that it was pretty embarrassing. And, you know, I said, I get it. I do. I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about other people. And if we can agree on this, I will let you create this account. You can add your friends and it'll be fine. And that's really what we did.
I could get a sense of her sense of humor coming through those quotes. Yeah.
Oh, she was something. She definitely did not hold back. She definitely would tell me what she thought. And a lot of it was humor or laughing at me for being, you know, lame or something. She always laughed at me.
So she started talking to these two boys and you did get their parents' phone numbers. At some point, did you allow her to make friends more without getting their parents' phone numbers, or what happened next?
So when she created this new MySpace account, I sat there, I was just fascinated really how quickly they could build these profiles with their, you know, surveys and questionnaires and blingy icons. And, you know, they could do all of these things and the layouts and everything that was a part of it. I watched her a lot of times and was just kind of amazed at how she knew instantly how to do these things. And, you know, once she started building it, she added a lot of her friends from her old school and friends from her new school. And again, because I monitored it, I had to sign her on. I had to log out. Any new friend requests that came in, I would, you know, she would say, "Hey, mom, so-and-so." And I would say, "Great, go ahead and add them." Well, the one day, it was a new boy by the name of Josh Evans who asked to be friends with her. He was a good-looking boy, and Megan looked at me and she's like, "Mom, can I add him? Please, he is so hot." And I'm like, and Megan used the word hot all the time. So I said, "Meg, who is he? Is he a friend of a friend, or how do you know him?" She goes like, "Mom, I don't know. He's just hot, please." And I said, "Megan, here's the thing. I will let you add him, but if there's anything negative, anything sexual, he is deleted immediately." And she said, "Okay, I promise." So many people, and if I looked back, I would think the same thing. Like, lady, you're so protective, but why would you do this? The reason is that I knew if I did not allow her to add somebody, she was going to do it behind my back. She would have went to a library. She would have went to a friend's house. She would have created a fake one again. I wouldn't know about it because now she would know how to erase all of her history. And I wouldn't know. So I thought at least if I did it this way, I could monitor it. If there's any issues, it would be deleted. Well, Josh, she added Josh, and her and Josh started talking, and Josh told Megan, you know, she commented on her picture. She was beautiful and had a beautiful smile, and she thought he was very cute. And they just started talking back and forth. You know, I was the mom who also would say, you cannot wear a t-shirt that has what school you go to. Do not put the school that you go to. Don't put the city that you live in. Don't put, you know, if you're going to go somewhere, don't put the mall you're going to. I was one of those that always said, you know, we have to be very careful. You don't know who's on the other side. And of course, Megan would roll her eyes and give me the hand of like, "Yeah, mom, I got it. I know." And that's how that friendship started with Josh Evans.
What was your impression of Josh Evans when you came across this account?
So, leery of Josh Evans' account. It just seemed, it was odd. He came out of the blue. You know, and the thing is, so that people understand, is that Megan had really between 7th and 8th grade, we switched her to different schools. And she was now in a different school and doing really, really well. Her self-esteem was starting to come back and blossom. And she was hanging out with friends, girls and guys, and just really happy on the volleyball team. So she wasn't in this place of where, you know, Megan came home and her only interaction socially was just online. That wasn't the case. But Josh was a boy who, you know, said he came from a single family home, moved into the area. Of course, Megan had this huge heart. So when anybody was struggling or gone through things, Megan would really feel bad. You know, he would tell her again that she was pretty, and but it wasn't as if it was instantly like, "Oh, this is, you know, my boyfriend." Because I would always say, "Meg, you can't, relationships online are not real relationships, because you truly don't know who the other person is, right? We can be whoever we want to be." And, you know, there was a time where Josh put Megan's picture on his profile, like a big picture, and said, "This is my girlfriend." And I looked at it and I was like, "Whoa, Megan, tell him to get that picture off of there. You know, that's not okay. I don't know what's going on." And it really got to the point where he only had a couple of pictures besides his profile. And I said, "Meg, I don't know. This, something doesn't seem right." And she was like, what do you mean, Mom? And I said, I don't even know if these pictures, I wonder if there's a way to find out if these pictures are real. And she had a boy who she was in her class, who she said, Mom, I know who I can talk to. He's really good at computers. He could figure it out. So she messaged him and said, hey, my mom is freaked out over this boy. And can you take a look at these pictures? And do they seem real, the photos? And the boy messaged her back and said, yeah, they do, but there's something creepy about this. And Megan said, Mom, see, the pictures are real. Well, me being the mom I was, I called the police. And I wanted to know, can I find out if a MySpace profile is real or not? And they said, you know, you need to go to call cybercrimes. So then I called cybercrimes. And they had said, you know, has anybody tried soliciting? Is there, or have you met somebody? Any of those? I said, no, it's just something doesn't feel right. Well, listen, lady, we don't have enough people there to be able to monitor all of these accounts because this was so brand new at the time. I said, okay. Well, Megan then told the boy that my mom called the popos to be able to see if this account is real or not. And then the response back from Josh Evans was, I honestly thought the kid would have came back and said, wow, your mom is a crazy bitch. Like, what is wrong with your mom? Something's not right. Why would she do that? Instead, it came back with, well, your mom is really just trying to look out for you. I thought, okay, that doesn't seem right. That does not blend well. And I said that to Meg, and I'm like, something's not right, Meg. And she's like, Mom, you know, you're just overreacting. Well, one day Megan went to school and she'd had an instant message and I had logged on to do some work. Well, when I logged on, there it pinged a message and it said, hey, are you home? And I looked at it and it was from Josh Evans. And I said, you know what? This is actually Megan's mom. And, you know, I really think that, you know, why don't you, I think it would be better off if you didn't talk to Megan anymore. You're 2 years older than her. And, you know, I think it would be better. Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I get it. You know, I thought for sure they would back off. Nope, not a chance. Continued to talk to her. And I told Megan about it, and she was horrified that I communicated to Josh while she was at school. And she made me promise, Mom, that is embarrassing. Please don't comment on anything until I'm home. I said, okay, I will make the deal with you. Because again, I was trying to keep this balance between her trust and her not going and creating a fake account where I didn't know, but balancing that. So I said, I promise, I will not open, I will not do anything, we'll turn the notifications off. That way, it will only be opened up when you get home. And then things kind of for a while just, you know, went on. And now it had been about 5 to 6 weeks. And that's when Megan was getting ready for her birthday. It was a Sunday, October 15th of 2006. Megan had two volleyball games that day. And that evening, she asked to sign on because she wanted to fill out her birthday invitations and was going to get names and talk to her friends. She got a message from Josh Evans, which was completely out of the blue, that said, I don't want to be friends with you anymore. You're not a nice person. And Megan said, Mom, what do you think that's about? And I'm like, honey, I have no idea. None. You know, people have bad days. Just send him a message. See what he says. She sent a message and said, what are you talking about? Where did you get this from? And there was no response. She was talking to her other friends and she went to check. Still no response. she sent another message and said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Meg, it's late. You've got to sign off." And that's when I had her sign off. The next day, Megan went to school. She was in a great mood, handed out her invitations. I picked her up. All of her friends were coming to her birthday party. And then she asks to sign on to MySpace, because back then we didn't have the phones that had instant access. It was still dial-up. So I told her I would sign her on, but she only had a few minutes because I had to get her sister off the bus. The message when I signed her on came in late the night before from Josh Evans to her, saying, "You heard me. No one likes you. No one wants to be friends with you." And Megan, you know, it wasn't this horrible message. It was just Megan was confused. She was like, "I am nice to people unless they're mean to me. I don't know what you're talking about." And now all of a sudden, the messages started going back and forth. And I said, "Meg, listen, you've got to sign off. Your sister's home. I've got to go." Megan said, "Mom, please let me finish this last message and I will." And typically, I always made sure she signed off, but it was raining really hard that day. I had to go grab her sister and I left. I called Megan two different times from the orthodontist office. Both times she was crying. The last time she was sobbing where I couldn't even understand her. And I said, "Please get off the MySpace." I came home. Megan was still sobbing at the computer. And I said, "Let me sit down." And I was tired and frustrated as a mom. I had been running all day. My other daughter was crying because her braces were tightened. Megan was crying because of this. There was still dinner, homework, showers, all of that. And when I sat down and looked at the computer, there were messages that went from Josh to Megan, Megan to Josh. Now Josh got two other girls involved. So now there were other girls involved in the mix. The messages that went back and forth were, you know, "Megan Meyer's a whore," "Megan Meyer's a fat ass." Those were about the nicest messages, and they used first and last names then. But then Megan was defending herself. So now Megan had reached out to a couple of her friends on private messaging saying, "Hey, will you help me with this person? Do you see what they're doing?" And I said, "Megan, I've told you the war of words will never work. I told you to sign off. If you would have signed off, we could have dealt with this differently." But it's turned into this huge explosion. I said, "Meg, you're none of these things that they're calling you." And she looked at me and she said, "Mom, it's going to everybody at my old school, everybody at my new school. No one's going to believe me." She said, "You're supposed to be my mom. You're supposed to be on my side." And she took off running. One of her friends called the home phone. And Megan picked it up and was crying and just said, I have to talk to you later. And she ran upstairs to her room. I tried looking at a little bit more of what happened, but I went upstairs into the kitchen and her dad came downstairs and said, "What is going on?" He started cooking dinner and we were talking about what was going on, and he didn't like anything to do with her taking photos, anything on the MySpace, anything to do with any of that. And, you know, he was frustrated with why she was upset because he thought none of this should happen. Probably 20 minutes later, I just had a horrible feeling that ran through my entire body. I stopped in mid-sentence and ran up to her room. I opened the door and I found Megan hanging in her closet. I screamed. Her dad came upstairs. I tried finding the phone. The weird part of it was is that as I was trying to dial out her home phone to 911, my younger daughter, Allison, was calling to see if dinner was ready to come home because she was across the street. And I was frantically screaming to hang up the phone, hang up the phone. And I had to run around and find my cell phone to call. And as I was dialing and calling 911, Ron, Megan's dad, was giving her CPR. And Allison ran home in the midst of all of it. And we screamed at her to go get our neighbors. Megan was not breathing. The paramedics arrived. They got Megan's heart started and got her to start breathing with assistance. And there was a small glimmer of hope of maybe she's going to make it through.
I'm terribly sorry about your loss. That's just devastating. And I appreciate all of these memories that you shared with us to bring her to life and let us remember what she was like. I wondered, you know, what were those first few days, few weeks without Megan like?
You know, there was, when Megan first was taken to the hospital, she was transferred. They could not airlift her because of the weather. And she was transported by a pediatric team to Children's Hospital. But she lived for 24 hours. And it got to the point where nothing was working. They felt that there was a couple of ups and downs where they thought maybe, but her blood pressure, everything, nothing they did was working. And the final piece was, do you want to put her on life support? And her dad and I both agreed that I didn't want her living like that. Megan was too full of life that I couldn't do that to her. And, you know, leaving the hospital with her there was, it felt like it wasn't real. Like this was not happening. We donated her heart valves, but going home, I couldn't go back to our house. We went and stayed at my mom's house. And I think it was trying to figure out, like, how does this happen? I mean, I don't know how to live without her. I mean, my kids are my entire life. And she was such an amazing kid that I didn't want to live. I didn't want to be alive anymore. I begged every night to please take me, even though I had another daughter that I loved with everything. It was so much pain to try to figure out how to breathe or how to function without her. It's still to this day, you know, there's days that it feels like, was she even real? You know, if I see her on TV or, you know, somewhere out of the country has her in educational books or somebody tells me something, it's kind of like, God, was she real? And then other days it can feel like it just happened. And, you know, I think a lot of the weeks after it was trying to figure out, like, who was this Josh Evans? Like, what happened? Was it a scared kid that, because that Josh Evans account deleted the night that Megan took her own life. It started peeling away in pieces. So when you close the account, it didn't just poof, gone. It started peeling away layers. And I couldn't figure out, like, what happened. I was like, is it a kid that was scared or was it an adult? And now that the Josh Evans photo was gone, I sat there for hours throughout the night, throughout the day, searching for, like, who was this person? Where did they go? What happened? And no matter what I did, I couldn't find anything. Like, it just all disappeared. And it was Thanksgiving weekend, and we had started going to a grief support group where I went, and I was trying to get my husband to go for other parents who had lost children to suicide. And I was going to go to one that weekend, and we got a call from a neighbor that I didn't know very well, saying that she asked if Ron and I would come to a meeting that day to a counselor's office, that she had to talk to me about Megan's death. And I was kind of like taken back and almost a little bit frustrated, thinking, I really don't know you. You're calling me on this weekend. I'm going to a grief support group. I don't know what to tell you. I don't want to sit there and listen to you asking questions about Megan's death. because no, I'm sorry, I'm going to this meeting. And I remember telling Ron about it, Megan's dad, and he didn't know. And then we got another call. And this call was from a man that lived in our subdivision who was a counselor who did talk to Ron and I during these times and said, I know that this woman, Michelle Mulford, called and you declined to go. But Tina, it is really important for you guys to attend this meeting. Do you have any other, you know, your parents, anybody that can be there to support you guys? I'm like, okay. You know, I was frustrated because I was desperately searching for support and I wanted this grief support group to give me a moment of being able to breathe without wanting to die. And we called Ron's mom. I called my aunt. I called some other people and we went to this meeting in O'Fallon, Missouri, and we walked in and it was in a counselor's office. And when they all had chairs in a circle and it was the mom, Michelle Mulford. It was another woman who was a counselor. It was Jim, who was the counselor in our subdivision. It was Tina Larrigan, who was a school counselor where Megan went to school before. And I walked in and I said, so you're going to tell me that the Josh Evans account was fake. Is that what you're going to tell me? And Michelle Mulford shook her head and said, yes. And then they told me that Michelle Mulford lived across the street from Lori Drew and in our subdivision and said that Lori Drew, her daughter Sarah, and Ashley Grills, an 18-year-old, created this fake MySpace account as a hoax to be able to trick Megan. The reason was because Megan and her daughter Sarah, their friendship dissolved when Megan switched to different schools. They heard that Megan had called her daughter a lesbian. Megan was not perfect. I don't know if Megan did or didn't. If I would have known, I would have said, come on, you know how it feels for people to call you names or to be mean and hurtful. You don't have to be friends with people, but just don't be mean. But I never had that opportunity to talk to her. Michelle Mulford found out the night that Megan took her own life because her daughter was friends with Sarah and would go to religion classes together and soccer practice together. And Lori Drew and the daughter told her about the fake account and how funny it was. So the night these things get really kind of confusing, but the night that the ambulance arrived and Megan took her own life, Lori Drew, the mom, called across the street and asked Michelle Mulford to talk to her daughter and told the daughter to delete that account, to keep her mouth shut, not say a word. And the daughter started crumbling. And the mom, over the next day, found out what had happened. And from that point on, the mom kept pressuring Lori Drew to please come forward and talk to us. She contacted a church, she contacted the police department, contacted the prosecuting department, contacted anybody and everybody and said, this family needs to know what happened. And this was her final solution to try to do something so that we knew. And when we found out, I think other people, now there was calls made to our other family. And I think they were worried that Ron was going to go down and kill them because this family lived four houses down the street. I think Ron was more in shock, where I was so angry. All I thought about doing was going and ripping them apart. That's all I wanted to do. And when we drove back home, we had family and neighbors kind of blocking the street so that we could not go down to the Drew's house, Lori Drew's house. and we pulled in the driveway and everybody was hysterical. Our family, our neighbors, everybody was sobbing, hysterical, emotions were everywhere. Everybody from one person that would say, no, don't go down there, the other person would completely lose it and want to go down there. And I tried running down there several times and was held back. And then I remembered that Lori Drew asked us to store a foosball table in the garage for their kids for Christmas. So in between when Megan took her own life and now, I helped Lori unload her kids' Christmas present, covered it up in the garage for her. This was also the same woman that when after Megan died, we went and knocked on their door and told Sarah because we wanted her to know to try to make sure she could be okay, where they came to Megan's wake and funeral. The same family that invited us to Sarah's birthday party to come down to their house to sing and have cake, which was 3 days after Megan's birthday, to sit there and watch us in absolute misery. And then to ask my younger daughter, Allison, to walk around with them on Halloween. Every single emotion that I had, realizing that they did nothing but relish in the fact of watching our complete pain. We grabbed, it sounds ridiculous now, but we grabbed the foosball table and one of us had a sledgehammer, one of us had an axe, and we destroyed the foosball table, put it in the back of Ron's truck, the big cardboard box, I spray painted Merry Christmas on it. We drove down the street, we unloaded it all behind their van and put the box there, came back home, and Lori Drew, her husband, and Sarah Drew, they sent Sarah in front of them, walked down the sidewalk with their hands in the air of, what's going on? What's happening? And they had, our neighbors went and told them if they knew what was good for them, that they would leave and go home. They sent then Laura or Sarah Drew, the 14-year-old now, to our front door to knock on our door to talk to us. And Ron told her to go home. Do not come back here again. Go home. Lori Drew then called the police department to file charges against us for destruction of personal property. And at that time is when Lori Drew told the police department, the police officer in the police report, why all of this was happening, that she created a fake account to gain Megan's confidence to find out if Megan was talking about her daughter behind her back. And that is the sole reason.
Oh, I really cannot imagine that grief and anger and what you experienced. I wonder what was the search for accountability like? What is accountability to you in circumstances like this?
You know, there's a fine line between a normal mental state and being absolutely losing your mind when these things happen. You do not think clearly. I mean, let alone a daughter taking her own life. But then this on top of it, you know, there's no processing this. There's no just going to a counselor, you know, meditation. There's no pill, no nothing that is going to make any of this ever seem okay. And so completely irrational thinking. The irrational thinking went from vengeance. I wanted them to feel what I felt. I wanted to go down there. At that time, that was the only way I saw justice to me, was vengeance. I wanted the family to be tied up, and I wanted their daughter to have to slowly take her last breath and them watch and feel the pain that we felt. That's what I wanted them to feel. And then I would have, because I vocalized it, you know, of course. And I had everybody saying, you cannot touch them. You cannot do anything. You have another daughter. And I would literally go back home and pray at night to give me the strength to not go down to hurt them. Because I would see them driving on the streets, taking their kids to school, acting like life was just normal again. And when I, you know, I don't hide anything. I am very transparent. There were, when I talk about losing your mind, when I saw them drive down the street, I would try to run them off the road. Like literally try to run them off the road. Everything inside of me, you could feel normal for a second. And then I would see them and it would take over me this rage of how dare you just go on about your life when you've done all of this. I had to start journaling to write down everything that I felt. I had to figure out some way to get this gone. And we then went and met with an attorney. I used to work for at a law firm, and so I knew he was one of the top criminal attorneys. We met with him. My aunt, by this point in time, my aunt had a banner at the front of our subdivision because there was one way in and one way out. And I was a real estate agent at the time. So we painted signs that said, Lori Drew is a murderer and lives down the street. If you want to know, ask us. When we went to the law firm, he quickly advised us to pull up the signs, to not talk to anybody about it. And got us in touch with the FBI. That's when the FBI investigation started. And the hope was at that time that if there was not going to be vengeance and they were not going to feel the pain, then there needed to be justice. Something needed to be done because I didn't want another family going through this. And we quickly realized that Lori Drew enjoyed talking to the FBI agent. The FBI agent came and took our computer. And then they said, listen, I'm not sure what she'll do, but we're going to go ask her for her computer so that we could start tracing this. Lori made them pancakes. Lori enjoyed talking about what happened. Didn't feel really that she did anything that wrong. And gave them her computer. And during this time, the 18-year-old girl, I got her, you know, I was able to talk to her because she begged for forgiveness. And I told her if she wanted to do something right, that she needed to go talk to the attorneys. She needed to go give a statement, tell the truth. That's all I wanted her to do. She did do that. And you know, this was a long drawn out process. It was probably 6 months that the prosecutor or the FBI investigated. When they came back, they were able to trace that every message that was going back and forth, instant message in MySpace, every single one was going from the Drew's house to our house, except for one that came from the one girl across the street because she knew the password. And she's the one that sent, you're not a nice person, because she was upset that Megan was talking to a boy that she liked. The FBI tried to get her prosecuted here. They said that there were no laws. They looked at child endangerment. They looked at child stalking. They looked at harassment. We didn't have any laws that were on the books about internet, you know, social media, any of those things. The FBI took it all the way up to Washington. There was even a bill, Violence Against Women's Act. I think that's when Bush put that in, signing that, and embedded in there. We pulled it out, embedded in there was these types of internet crimes. I called the White House. My aunt called the White House. We made copies of it. We took it to every jurisdiction we could think of. and nobody, they felt no one could prosecute it. And I thought, what are we supposed to do now? And I remember the one FBI agent who was phenomenal. His name was Billy. And he said, Tina, don't give up. Don't give up. Get the laws changed. I thought, okay, great. How do you do that? I have no idea. I thought about it. And at this time, I was also going through a divorce. You know, the thing is, when you go through these traumatic experiences, many times marriages don't make it. So it was a lot of different moving parts. And my aunt saw a newspaper article about MySpace and contacted the journalist, Steve Pokin, said, will you talk to my niece? She wants to get the laws changed. And this guy, Steve Pokin, from a local journal, came and did the story, went to my old house where Ron was still living. Ron gave his side. They published the article, but they did not, because I thought, this finally is going to get Lori Drew's name out there, right? This finally is going to get everybody to see, because in between this time, it's about a year, there were people that thought that we just were trying to blame people for Megan's death. Like, we were trying to push blame on somebody else, and really it must have been us. And I wanted to, like, clear Megan's name. I wanted people to know. And he refused, or his publisher refused, to release Lori Drew's name. I was not happy. And I told him how unhappy I was about it. You know, I get why they have to do certain things for protection of children, and I get all of that now. But I was not happy. But the reality is that one newspaper article that went out got the attention of a blogger out of state. The blogger out of state contacted the journalist and started pushing this out. And all of the things that I ever wanted to be able to do to the Drews, everybody, they all did this. I mean, they, people that found out about this and read about it and heard about it, because now it's on news, you know, in newspapers and on blogs. And, that was even before the big viral, you know, where everything went viral. Now, you know, we had news stations and national media and all of that were starting to come about wanting to hear about the story. You know, back then, when a local news station, we called them about the story, they said, we don't do suicide, especially on youth. We don't do those stories. Now people in the out that I didn't know, you know, were able, they hacked into Lori Drew's home phone number. They hacked into her cell phone number. They contacted every single business that she did business with. Her business got shut down. They did things that I was like, because again, to some people, this may sound horrible. I wanted their life to be a living hell. I wanted them to live the hell that I was living. And so I remember I went on Bill O'Reilly one time, a show, and he was like, don't you feel like these vigilantes, don't you feel bad for the Drews? Because, you know, they've done all of these things to them. Don't you feel bad? I was like, are you kidding me? I'm not doing it. First of all, this is the public opinion. What they did was so incredibly wrong. And it's really hard for people to understand, how could a mom be involved in doing this? We get it more when kids do this, right? But when a mom does this, I'm sorry, they're all still alive. So she has to figure out a new business. You want me to feel sorry for her? Sorry, I don't. They have to move. You want me to feel sorry about that? I don't. No, I'm don't feel sorry. And, you know, I thought, at least at that point, I thought, okay, this is, we got the laws changed in the state of Missouri, and this is where we need to go. And then I get a call from the LA Times, and they said, are you aware about the indictment of Lori Drew? And I was like, what? I have no clue what you're talking about. They said, well, a federal grand jury indicted Lori Drew. I was like, oh, or they're talking about indicting Lori Drew. And I said, okay, I don't know anything about it. So I got off the phone and one of the producers from the Today Show called and said, Tina, can you get on a plane in an hour? I'm like, I am back over at my old house. I am in the process of cleaning out Megan's room. It was horribly hard to do. My hair is in a ponytail. I'm in sweatpants and you want me to get on a plane. I'm like, yes, you've got to get on a plane. You've got to go. You've got to go. And I'm thinking, every time that when we started this in the beginning, I remember my aunt, when I would be like, I can't do another interview. I cannot do another TV show. I cannot do this anymore. I'm exhausted. She would say, Tina, what if there's another Megan out there? What if there's another you out there? And so every time these things would happen, I would be, okay, like, I have to. And, you know, I would get comments from people that would say, oh, she loves the attention. She must be getting paid a lot of money. You know, how sick are you to be getting paid in Megan's death? I thought, do you people have any? First of all, my eyes were swollen half the time because I cried all the time. You do not get paid for any of these interviews. They pay for your flight and a hotel stay. You get up at 4 a.m. They smack makeup on you. You're on there for 3 minutes and you go home. It's exhausting. I did it because that's every single time, even still to this day. It's if there's another Megan out there listening, if there's a parent, an educator, somebody out there listening, that's what we have to do. And when I flew back, Good Morning America producers were there at the house filming something. And I got a call from the U.S. attorney at the time, Thomas O'Brien. And he said he wanted to inform me that Lori Drew was officially charged on 4 counts. The federal grand jury did indict her. She faced up to 20 years in prison. And that they are going to keep in contact with me. The victim advocate group would be in contact with me, but they are planning on going to trial. And I was shocked. I told him, thank you. And Thomas O'Brien flew out to St. Louis at the FBI's office. And I met with him and he said that when they found out about the story that because MySpace's headquarters were based in Los Angeles, that he felt it was such an injustice that she was not charged. And when they found out, they knew it was a long shot, but when they found out that they could indict her and she faced for violating terms of service, the different charges, that they felt that it was worth taking a stand to do this. And I will tell you, Mark Krause was another prosecuting attorney there. I will never be able to say how grateful I am for all of the endless hours, the hard work that they all did, knowing that it was a long shot, but standing up for the rights of kids all over the country that struggled through this because it was the first case that was able to take a stand. And now the ACLU and other people coming in and saying, we can say whatever we want online. Well, can you really say whatever you want? Is it protected speech? And so, you know, even though eventually with the trial, it turned out she was, you know, charged with 3 counts. The judge ultimately overturned the case and said too many people lie on social media. It would be unconstitutional. And I cried. The prosecuting attorneys cried. Our whole family cried afterwards because it was so much work. And it was Thomas O'Brien cross-examined Sarah Drew, the 14-year-old. And it was the first time in 30 years that a U.S. attorney did any type of cross-examination in a trial. That's how much it meant. And I realized at that point in time that our foundation, because I started that in 2007, that looking at Lori Drew and realizing the vengeance was gone. Really, it was more of justice. And even though she didn't face jail time, justice was now people knowing about the story, now talking to their kids, now making changes, laws being changed. And for me, Megan was so much more than this angered part, this piece that happened to her. And if I can honor her life to help others and parents and kids, that's what I was going to do. And it's what we still do today, this many years later.
Now, did Lori Drew ever apologize to you?
That is the number one question that I get asked from usually adults and kids. Lori Drew wrote a letter, a handwritten letter that I still have, that stated that, and this was after Megan died and after we found out they were involved, said that she understands that we blame her for Megan's death, but that she would really like to talk to us and explain us to us about their side of the story, that they felt that was really important. At that time, there was not a word in any language that that woman could have said that would have made a difference. She had had 6 weeks in between us finding out to have some remorse to do the right thing. She didn't. So it was best for me, honestly, to not put myself in that place to talk to her because nothing good would have came.
I wondered if you have a little bit more time, I would like to ask a few questions about your foundation. And
sure.
You said you started in 2007. How did this come about?
So that aunt of mine, who is like my second mom, said, you know, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm not going to be a real estate agent. I don't care if the house falls down. Like, my priorities, everything that I valued in life has gone. So I knew I wanted to help other kids. I didn't know how to do that or what that looked like. And my aunt said, so we're going to do it. And she got a federal identification number. We came up with the name. We registered that. She gave me the first $100 to open up the checking account for the foundation. And she found an attorney that would help draft our bylaws and incorporation and get everything done. And it's the Megan Meyer Foundation, and the mission is to support and inspire actions to end bullying, cyberbullying, and suicide. What that looked like beyond that, I had not a clue. But I started getting calls. Now that everything was out there, I got calls from different places, and one of them was an insurance company for school districts. And they said, will you come speak to superintendents about your story and at this huge conference? And I said, sure, I don't know what I'm going to talk about or how do I get this out? And I went, it was about a year after Megan passed away. And I went to the conference and I think I cried half the time through it. But there's like 300 or 400 superintendents for schools, and I told Megan's story. And once I got done, I started getting superintendents, you know, will you come speak at our school? How much will it cost? I was like, I don't know, $350. I don't know. I just pulled it out of my head. It's like, you know, 4-hour drive. I'm like, sure, $350. I don't know. And I started going and speaking to schools. And, you know, at this time, my aunt thankfully was letting me work at her office while I was doing this so I could at least get paid because I wasn't getting paid through the foundation. We started in 2007 and I didn't get paid until like 2011. So anytime we made any money, it just went straight into the foundation. And, you know, we started a golf tournament to try to raise funds. And it started really with organically with going to schools and speaking. And the first several times I did it, it was Megan's story, but it was also about thinking how you treat other people. And then as time went on and I was able to sit down and talk to kids after speaking, and kids from all walks of life, about what they're feeling, what they're going through, I was able to then start incorporating different pieces into it and talking about what bullying is and cyberbullying. And yes, talking about suicide, but a lot of it is empathy driven, trying to get kids to understand what it would feel like in another person's shoes. And, you know, I still travel and speak today. And each and every time it takes a piece, you know, it's emotionally and a toll, because when I do it, my whole purpose of doing it is to, if I can connect with one kid, if I walk out of here and I've just helped one kid in a school of 5,000 and I can help them, then it was worth it coming. And so you try to give it everything that you've got to try to make that difference. And, you know, today the foundation, now we have done interactive workshops. We, you know, have a counseling and support center that we provide counseling in schools and in our offices. We have 6 contracted therapists. And we, you know, work with families all over the world that are struggling with their kids, and we listen, support, provide them resources, guidance, and helping them. And so, you know, we have a long way to go. It's still, even though we've accomplished so much, we want to make sure that there are supports in every single school. And we want to make sure that when a parent is scared and doesn't understand, that they have supports and guidance on what to do. We want to make sure kids know that people do care, that there is help there. And so we're going to continue to keep pushing and fighting every single day to make sure that kids feel happy and healthy and know that they're wanted and supported.
Have you noticed any changes in the way people understand or talk about cyberbullying since 2007?
Oh yeah, there's a huge difference. In the beginning, kids especially, we have pre and post surveys that we do for schools. And in the beginning, it was, kids were very much more open, middle school and high school kids, more open to talk about, yes, I've been bullied. Yes, I've witnessed bullying. Yes, cyberbullying. And then it kind of started tapering off, where they didn't show that high percentage was, it was shifting. And so we started asking open-ended questions, which was, you know, what do you wish adults knew about your life? What do you wish, like, because I kept hearing from them, adults don't get us, adults don't understand, adults, you know, so as I wanted that open-ended. And, you know, do you know of anybody, you or yourself, that is in danger or you're concerned about? We asked those questions, and that is when we started to see that shift, where they would say, nope, they do not, you know, it's not happening to them. But then they would start talking about it in open-ended questions, right? Because the change was, they started hearing about it so much that it needed to be these big, huge stories online for them to feel like they were bullied or cyberbullied. So they didn't realize that the constant name-calling really was bullying. They knew it wasn't okay, but they didn't want to feel like they were a baby and crying about it, you know, just suck it up. And so they would then talk about it more in the open-ended questions about how it made them feel. And even still today, the things that have shifted even more so is that they will still talk about it, but it's not quite so much about bullying and cyberbullying. It's more about how they cannot take the pressure, how people are cruel. They talk about their anxiety, their stress, that a lot of things that are going on in their home life that students don't get it. They don't understand how hurtful or harmful they can be, that they don't think adults get it. And so we're really seeing a lot of that, of them talking about that social and emotional piece, how they're really struggling and feeling like they don't fit in, like there's not a place in this world for them. And so it's really, really hard to read those. You know, your heart hurts when you see that, because you want them to know that they matter.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of parents turn to you for advice on how to protect their children from what exists on the internet. And what kind of advice would you give someone who is worried at this moment?
You know, I wish there was a perfect solution. If you do A, B, C, or D, this is what is going to protect them. But the reality is there's not. So what we talk about, if there's a way, is at the beginning, when you introduce your child to the iPad, introduce them to the phone that they want to play on, making sure that you set up those limits, you know, restrictions at that time, but then not letting them lay in bed and fall asleep with it, not keeping it in their bedrooms, making sure that they only have certain time on it and restrictions. As they start getting older, talking to them about why you want them to be safe online. And even talking to them about, even if they're playing a game, you know, let's say that you were playing a game and someone says something really mean. How would you handle that? You know, what would you do? Who would you come talk to us? And so I think talking about those discussions ahead of time and saying, you know, let's talk about, let's write down what are some things that you could do. Say that mom and dad are busy or both working and it happens. Here are some things. Let's write it down. I'll write it down. We'll keep track of it. And so those things as they go on. And then once they get a little bit older, middle school, is talking to them about the real stories. There is nothing more powerful than, you know, telling a kid about, here is why as a parent I'm worried. I hear these stories, right? And all I can do is think about, I don't know what I would do if it happened to you. But did you ever hear about, you know, what happened to this kid or this child? And what would you do? You know, do you feel that you could come talk to me? Because sometimes maybe I do get upset about things, you know? So it's those open conversations of talking to them is really important about what to do. And here's, you know, as you grow older, we'll do some of those restrictions. But as of right now, here's where it's at. And I want to make sure if you're struggling, let's write down who would you go to? Who would you talk to if I'm not here? And so we talk to them a lot about that, but that policy of zero tolerance of do as I say, it's my house and this is how it's going to go and I'll take your technology away. They're just going to learn how to hide it quicker. And that's the hardest part.
How did you monitor your other daughter's social media from that point on?
You know, I think after Megan took her own life and, you know, all of the social media was involved, I wanted to place my other daughter, Allison, in a bubble, you know, and just protect her. Like, no one touch her, no one do anything to her. And, you know, when social media, because she was 10 and a half when Megan took her own life. And, you know, now she's 12 and 13. And then, you know, she wanted social media. She wanted a cell phone. And I was scared. But I also really, truly did not want her to suffer because of what Megan went through. I didn't want her to have to live with everything of, you can't do this because Megan took her own life, or that what happened to Megan is going to happen to you. I didn't want to do that. And so I was open and honest with her, and I did monitor her. If anything, honestly, I was a little bit more relaxed. First of all, Allison did not have the ADHD component that Megan did. But Allison was a little bit more open than Megan was. I remember it took me several days to ask her if she'd ever had thoughts of suicide, because my biggest fear was of her saying yes, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I had to take each thing and almost like face my fears and try to work through it, because I truly wanted Allison to try to live as normal of a life as she could. Because she had her, you know, her whole world was turned upside down. Mom and dad divorced. Her sister took her own life. The entire world of media was in our faces, at our front doors, at every aspect, the trial, everything. And I refused to let her go on camera. I refused to let them see her, talk to her, anything with her. I did not want her to have to live that. I wanted her to try to be as normal as she could be. And so, you know, thankfully, she did do really, really well. Probably anybody that thought about bullying her, cyberbullying, probably thought twice, probably because who she was, you know, because they knew that my mouth was vocal. I was, you know, I monitored, but it still did not keep her from being picked on, you know, when she was in high school. It wasn't severe, but it was enough. But, you know, she's 26 now, and I look back and I do think it was the right thing to do to allow her to have that and in the right and normal ways versus trying to keep it from her, because she still would have figured it out.
One thing that's struck me when I was reading about your experience is just how young you were when this was happening. You had Megan when you were 21. Is that correct?
Yes, like, I had Megan when I was, let's see, I just turned 22 and I had Allison when I was 26. Yeah, it's a lifetime ago. But you know,
so you were in your early 30s when,
yes,
when you were going through all of this. That's just,
yeah,
it's incredible to me.
Yeah, I was 36 and, you know, yeah, it's, I've aged quite a bit, I can tell you. I still don't feel like I'm 51, but you know, the thing is, I look back and I feel, compared to some people in this world, even through everything we've gone through, I am truly so blessed to have had Megan as my daughter. Even though I wish she was here, she taught me so much about life, and her life continues to, I'm so proud of who she was, continues to keep helping other people. And I feel, as sad as I am, as proud of her and the foundation as I possibly can be. But yeah, I was young. It flashed. The time goes by very quickly. And some days very slowly, right?
Thanks for listening to Main Accounts, the story of MySpace, an iHeart original podcast. Main Accounts, the story of MySpace, is written and hosted by me, Joanne McNeil. Editing and sound design by Mike Coscarelli and Mary Dew. Original music by Elise McCoy. Mixing and mastering by Josh Fisher. Research and fact-checking by Austin Thompson, Jocelyn Sears, and Marissa Brown. Show logo by Lucy Quintanilla. Special thanks to Ryan Murdoch, Grace Views, and Vahid Frazier. Our associate producer is Lauren Phillip. Our senior producer is Mike Coscarelli. And our executive producer is Jason English. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Sadly, my MySpace page is no longer around, but you can find me on Twitter at Joe Mick. Let us hear your MySpace story. And check out my book, Lurking. Main Accounts, the story of MySpace, is a production of iHeart Podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.